Hello, welcome to Frame by Frame, a song-by-song analysis about legendary progressive rock band King Crimson. Come and join us in our test of discipline. Hello, everybody. We are back. That's right, the Frame by Frame podcast has returned. And this time we are going to be talking about the other part of that King Crimson band that when they broke up, they decided, what are we doing next? So before we get into that, this is Thrack, as always, and joining me as always is Avery. Ave, how you been?
Oh, not bad. How about you?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. Been doing a lot in the podcasting realm, but, you know, on the more video game side, that's where I tend to be these days. But it's always still nice to have this.
Yeah.
You know, because I have to get these sort of things out of me, talking about music. Because with them, it's not always as easy. You know, it's not always, but it is what it is.
And I've just had like the past 7 years of my life dedicated to prog.
Yeah, I guess I'm just one of those people. I have so many different interests. It's like I need little groups for everything. They don't intermingle that much. But anyways, enough of that. Let's get into the meat of the episode. Hopefully this won't be as long as the Fripp episode, even though we're talking about a lot more people. So basically, when King Crimson broke up in 74, and, you know, Fripp had sort of his idea of what to do, the other two guys in the band, Wetton and Bruford, were like, oh, shit, what the hell do we do now? And they kind of drifted apart and then kind of came back together and then drifted apart even further to where they were on just complete opposite ends of the spectrum, really.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting because this is sort of the last time we can really talk about Wetton in any sort of depth, really, because it's sort of the end of the road for him and King Crimson. But we can start. Yeah, let's start with Wetton, shall we, since it'll be the end of him. So after, well, the end of him in this tenure. I know he passed away years ago. Anyway. So Wetton was a bit of a busy man after this. He immediately went in and joined Roxy Music for about a year, I think. He didn't play on any of the records. He did appear a little bit on their Viva Live album, which I have not heard. Ave, I don't think you've heard it either.
No. Yeah, we both discussed this live before we started recording. Neither of us are big Roxy Music fans. Like, I've tried to get into them, but they just never really clicked with me.
Yeah, I described it as they're a little too British for my taste. You know, just something about them, it's like they don't click with me. You know, I wouldn't say they're bad or anything like that. I think they got inducted in the Hall of Fame a couple years ago. You know, good for them. And yeah. We love Eno. We all love Eno around here. But, you know, Eno went on to better things after this. And this is probably where Wetton met Eddie Jobson. Because Eddie Jobson was brought in to replace Eno after he left, and he stayed there for a good couple years. So I imagine this is where that sort of friendship was created, and they found they had a bit of a chemistry. Because I think I think you know that Wetton had more of a desire to be more on sort of the pop side of things than the prog side of things, you know. And this was sort of him joining Roxy Music was him starting to go into that direction, I would say.
Do you think, though, that maybe Eddie Jobson and John Wetton had already met? Because, I mean, we know, like, when they put out the live album USA after King Crimson's breakup, like, as we know, Eddie Jobson overdubbed David Cross. So was that before or after?
I believe that was after, because Red came, or USA, I think, came out in 75. And from the information I found, Wetton basically right after Crim went right into Roxy Music. Like, apparently he was already like sitting in on sessions while he was still in Crimson. So my guess is that's probably where they met. And then that was probably where Wetton got the idea to get Jobson in to clean up some of the violin parts for USA. Because that came out in 75 and he left shortly after that as well. But my guess is they stayed in touch. So, you know, if you guys want to hear, you know, Wetton's bubbly bass under Brian Ferry talking about whatever he talks about, you know, there you go. But Wetton also had a short stint in a a different band, at least in terms of all of this. You know, Ave, I don't know how much you know about the band Uriah Heep. I'm sure you've heard the name before.
Yes, I have. I don't know a whole lot about them, but I've heard John Wetton was in that.
Yeah, Uriah Heep are one of those bands that they formed roughly around the same time as Crimson, I think, in the same year, but they were more like hard rock kind of inspired. You know what I mean? They almost were like, I may get criticism for this because I'm not saying it. They're more like a Vanilla Fudge or like a heavy psychedelic band that kind of went into more proggy stuff that way. They did have some Roger Dean album covers on The Magician's Birthday, Demons and Wizards. They have a really cool album called Salisbury where the front cover is just a tank. And it's really cool.
Oh, nice.
They're definitely more of like a grittier kind of like prog band than say like a Yes or something like that. You know what I mean? And also famously, they were the band that Rush first opened for when they started touring with Neil Peart. They opened for them at the start as well, which is pretty cool. And then I think it was quite a few years later, Rush ascended beyond them and then had Uriah Heep open for them as sort of like a return favor. But yeah, I don't know a huge amount of Uriah Heep's music outside of the first handful of records, like Salisbury, Look at Yourself, Demons and Wizards, Magician's Birthday. Those are actually all really solid albums.
Oh, Look at Yourself is the one that has the like the mirror, like that reflective part on the cover, right?
Yes.
I've seen that. I went to this antique store in Providence and I saw that there.
Yeah, I think the idea was that they came up with the album title first. And then they're like, wouldn't it be cool if we put just like, you know, a little bit of like shiny paper so, you know, it would be a more direct sort of connotation. And it's interesting to see. I have seen the album in person. It's fascinating because you're not expecting to look at yourself, but, you know.
I like when album artwork matches the album title. Like another great instance of that I can think of is the American cover of Moon Madness by Camel. It's just
that cover's
it's a camel
so weird.
In a space suit on the moon.
Yeah, it's so weird, man.
Like, I love it. I got a shirt of it from Redbubble.
Of course you did. I much prefer the British cover, even though I'm not sure if that's like an animal or a rock. I think it's a rock with like a little moss on it, but it looks like a creature or something. But you know, I've never been the biggest fan of that Moon Madness record. I don't know why. It's a good album, but I don't know. Just didn't click with me as much as everybody else. But in any case, we're not talking about Camel. Yeah. So Wetton appeared on two Uriah Heep records, Return to Fantasy and High and Mighty. The cover of High and Mighty is pretty fascinating. It's like a gun with airplane wings on it, which is quite the sight to look at. So, in fact, I will go ahead and send it to you in the chat so you can... Oh, wait. Can I not do... Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, no. Fuck that shit. Oh, here's the private chat. There you go. See, I want you to look at that cover.
That's interesting.
it is. Now, I have not heard either of these records, so I cannot attest to their quality or not. All I will say is for Return to Fantasy, it has a 3 out of 5 from AllMusic, and High and Mighty has a 2 out of 5. So if that's any indication of quality, I'll leave it to you with that. But on both records, Wetton is credited with, like songwriting at least one of the tracks. And, I think he sings quite a bit on here. He's probably not the lead singer, but he does some lead vocals and all that. It's definitely more of the, when he was in, say, like Mogul Thrash or Family, you know, where he was just kind of like the bass player and occasional singer in the back, kind of supporting them, which must have been weird for him to return to that after being in such a prominent role with such a prominent band. But I think it was he just needed some, like maybe just some steady income while he figured out what was next for him.
Yeah. You know? And with John Wetton, I kind of assume like, he was more of like a bassist first and then like a singer second.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even if you listen to say like Easy Money, right? The studio version of that, and then compare it to Starless, and his vocals had changed drastically in that time, you know? I think he's just gotten more confident with singing because he had to sing so much. So by the time we get to, say, UK, he is a singer at this point. He's absolutely a singer. And I think we can brief, well, UK is what would be next for him. But funnily enough, before we get to UK, there's a weird little thing that I had heard about off and on here and there. There's not a huge amount of information on it, but I wanted to touch upon it. Have you ever heard of the original idea for UK?
I'm not sure. What was it?
So the original idea was it was going to be Wetton and Bruford, but they were going to get in Rick Wakeman.
Oh.
It would have been like Wakeman, Wetton, Bruford. And the idea was it was going to be sort of like the next incarnation of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. You know, it's a keyboard-led trio with three very prominent musicians of that era, of that time. And I think by this point, ELP were still on hiatus because Works Volume 1 came out in late 77, I think. So
and then Love Beach, I think, came out in 78.
I'm glad you brought up Love Beach.
iconic cover.
Yes. But yeah, the Wakeman, Wetton, Bruford thing, I think, was the initial idea for it. According to a biography of Rick in the late 70s, it was going to be called British Lion, apparently, which is, I'm not sure how I feel about that title, but, you know, it is what it is. Yeah, there's one interview with Bruford, and I think it's in 1980, where he talks about it pretty prominently, that they were working on it, a version of Beelzebub from Feels Good to Me. They did that. In the Dead of the Night was also being worked on by them as well. There's no recorded documentation as far as I could find. But I guess according to Bill Bruford, it didn't happen because Wakeman's record label, A&M, didn't want their superstar keyboardist to have to be forced to work with the, you know, like out of date, slightly, I think the term he used was slightly soiled, you know, used King Crimson rhythm section. You know, I guess A&M didn't like that idea.
Wow.
So it never happened. But it might have been for the best, because I think had Wakeman jumped onto this, he wouldn't have been available for Going for the One.
Yeah. You know? And like, I also just, I know, like, obviously we know, like, Wakeman and Bruford worked pretty well together and, like, you know, the 71, but I have to wonder how well he would fit, like, with that, like, Bruford at that point, plus John Wetton, where, like, that rhythm section was, like, so loud and heavy, and Rick Wakeman kind of had more like classical sensibilities and like it really have that like that like the skill for improv that Bruford and Wetton did.
I agree. Even though I don't think this trio would have done a lot of like improv or any kind of crazy stuff, it probably would have been them doing more like songs and compositions, especially because you have Wetton at this time really exploring his songwriting chops. And then you have Bruford kind of doing his weird jazzy thing. And Rick Wakeman is not a jazzy player in any sense. So I don't know how he would have fit in with all of this.
Yeah.
And Bruford has said it was for the best that it didn't work out. Because I think he theorized it as they would have tried to push this as like the next ELP. And that would have been a lot to live up to, especially because ELP was very much its own beast entirely. And I just think the mix of members, and they all probably would have had a completely different idea of what they wanted to do, and it probably just wouldn't have worked out. So instead, Wetton and Bruford famously picked one guy each to form a four-piece to make UK. Obviously, John Wetton chose Eddie Jobson from his time with him in Roxy Music and doing the King Crimson overdubs. And I believe Jobson had already done a stint in Zappa's band at this point. So I know he worked with Zappa in the mid-70s-ish. It was like that weird, like, Zootalures time where Zappa was doing the lather box set, but then he was having like record label issues and he had a falling out with his manager, Herb Alpert. I think it was Herb. No, it was Herb Cohen. Herb Alpert's another guy. Herb Cohen. And then it was like on Warner Brothers. It was a whole, that's a whole mess. That's a whole nother thing.
Yeah. Entirely.
But so Jobson had kind of been around as well. And I guess him and Whetton just had just a nice chemistry that they brought in. And they're essentially the pop side of UK. So we can now talk about the jazzy side, which is, of course, Bill Bruford. Bruford was much more prolific pre-UK. I think the first thing he did post-Crimson was that little stint in Gong, I believe.
Yeah.
And he was there for, what, like 2 months or something
like
that?
Yeah, so he didn't record anything with them. Like he was there for just a couple months, and he didn't like it because, like, the hippie commune that they had going on was not his scene.
Yes, there is one live bootleg of him, which you can find online. And I mean, it's kind of what you expect. It's Gong. It's still during that that Teapot trilogy. I think he came in, I think it was between the second and third, because their album, well, those three albums are fantastic. I recommend them all. I haven't listened to them in a while. Fuck,
they're
they
fun.
Called? They are. Yeah, Gong is a fun band. Until
that
it,
trilogy like, was Flying Teapot, Angel's Egg, and You.
That's right. And I think he had joined like between Angel's Egg and You, but he, you know, didn't, but he doesn't have any like, you know, genuine credits or anything.
Yeah.
I do have Bill's book here. Let's see if I can find, because I know he talked about Gong a little bit because, you know, he kind of had to. Because I'm sure people asked him about it a bunch, like, "What the fuck? You were in Gong of all bands?"
I know, right?
Because I think it was their mainstay drummer Pierre Morleone. I'm saying that name right? Like, he was kind of in between stints with the band, so I think they were thinking, "Oh, let's get another more kind of jazzier player," because Pierre is a very jazzy kind of a drummer. So that was probably their thinking.
But unfortunately for them, just because Bill liked jazz didn't mean he also liked jazz cabbage. So that didn't work out for too long.
I imagine he partaked, but it wasn't anything he stuck with.
Yeah, he does mention that in the autobiography. It's something, and he was it with, yes, something about stately weed.
Stately weed.
I say, this is some dank shit.
Imagine Bill saying that. Yeah. Yeah, there isn't like, yeah, basically, yeah, it talks about the like the communal living that they were doing, and it just really wasn't his style, you know, because Bruford's a bit more formal than that. You know, he's not like Bruford's not a hippie. Not at all. He's more of like a professional. In fact, like, I think it was Richard Branson had asked him about it, because Gong, I believe, were on Virgin at the time, and he said he equated it to being like the beginning of his hired gun phase. And in a way, this kind of was his, like, him trying to be a side man, because I think he saw Whetton was doing it and had success with it, and he thought maybe he should give it a shot. So he did that little stint with Gong. He also appeared on, I think it's just one Roy Harper album. He might have been on another. I know he was on Roy Harper's HQ record, which is actually a really solid record. I'm quite a bit of a Roy Harper fan. And HQ is definitely one of his better records, in my opinion. Like, that album also has Dave Gilmour on it, John Paul Jones on it, Chris Spedding.
Wow.
Yeah, like, Roy Harper definitely commanded respect amongst his peers at that time.
So what exactly was his role? Because I know, like, Led Zeppelin, hats off to Roy Harper.
Oh, well, you mean like Roy Harper? Well, Roy Harper, he was just one of those folky singer-songwriters of that era. But he was very, very successful and popular in Britain. And he had, like, close ties with Zepp. Because on his famous album, Stormcock, from 1971, that album is essentially him and Jimmy Page just, like, just doing like acoustic stuff together. And I haven't listened to it in a long time, but I remember being incredible. Like, that album is genuinely incredible, because Roy, a fantastic guitar player, great singer. He's also a writer. He was part of that British folk seen. But I think he was one of those guys that kind of stood up and stood out from just being very accomplished and having the connections with, say, Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and all that. Because obviously he sang on Have a Cigar, from Wish You Were Here.
Yeah.
Because I guess Waters and Gilmore just couldn't get the voice right. And Roy was, I think he was working on HQ at the same time. And he just kind of stormed in and is like, I'll do it. And he did it. And Waters and Waters has said he regrets having him do it, that he kind of just wished he had done it. But I think having a different voice there makes that song work. You know, it adds that little cynicism that it needs. So if it was just like Roger singing it, I don't think it would work as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Roy Harper did a really good version of that. Just getting that, like, that sarcasm and like cynicism through.
Yeah. So listener at home, if you haven't listened to Roy Harper, please do yourself a favor. Like, go through his records. I think you'd be amazed. I don't know if he's on Spotify, but you can find his stuff. It's all very, very well made music. Let's see. Bill also, this was during that like Yes Solo record era. So Bill actually appears on, well, he technically is on three Yes. Well, he's on quite a few Yes Solo records. Like, he appears on Six Wives
of Water.
Well, he appears on Six Wives of Henry VIII with Rick Wakeman, which is when he was still in Crim. But it's cool hearing him in there. He appears on Steve Howe's Beginnings album as well. And I've never been a big fan of that Beginnings record. I think the Steve Howe album, the second one's a lot better. And I believe Bill's on there as well. But Abe, as you had said before I rudely interrupted you, he was on Chris Squire's Fish Out of Water. Which is weird when you think about it, because Bill and Chris famously didn't get along.
Yeah,
I believe they had a fist fight during the Fragile sessions. Like, and it was over music. Of course, these two would fist fight over.
I remember reading a fist fights like plural. Like, this was just like, they just throw hands on the reg.
Yeah, and like. Because I believe they roomed together, and you know, Chris Squire famously would stay forever in the bathroom, the Fish, and that pissed Bill off. Because I guess Chris Squire was just notoriously like late and slow to everything, and Bill is very punctual. So they just like their personalities couldn't be any more distant. And yet, I think you would agree with me that personality clash made their musical chemistry work.
Yeah. Yeah, like you can hear that, and like probably the best example of that would be Heart of the Sunrise, that intro where Bill is just like drumming against Chris's melodic bass line.
Yeah, they're both very busy players, and it almost feels like they're trying to compete with each other, but in that competition there is like beautiful cooperation, and it just creates this really lovely musical union between the two of them. You know, no pun intended on the union thing.
I think they probably noticed that, and I would guess that like once it had been like 3 years since Bill left to join King Crimson, like probably those like resentments and grudges and tensions just didn't really matter as much. So they probably had a better time recording that album than like anything with Yes.
Yeah, you're probably correct on that. And again, I think it was more of Chris hiring Bill as like, again, a hired gun. Because it definitely comes off that way. And it's probably like, oh, this will give it a little bit of a Yes connection. Because also Patrick Mraz is on that record before he got kicked out.
Another thing with having Bill there, it kind of makes me think of like, you know, like when you're growing up, like you and your siblings are always fighting. But then like once you grow up and move out, when you see each other again, like it's like, hey, how you doing? Like it's just like way more chill because like you're not fighting over like who ate the last Oreo or whatever.
I think they definitely had some growing up to do between the two of them. And it seemed to work out. In their favor, because that Fish Out of Water record is very, very good. I think in that like Yes Solo album, that little brief period there, most people put Fish Out of Water at the very top. To me, it's like it's either number one or number two. I think it's between that and John Anderson's Elias. Of Sun Hilo. How the hell do I remember that off the top of my head? Yeah, that album is pretty fascinating for what it is. I think I have a vinyl copy over here. Yeah, that Fish Out of Water record is very strong. Like Lucky Seven, I think I have it in like my normal just music playlist. So it'll come on occasionally and I will enjoy it.
Yeah.
And Bill's drumming is fucking incredible on that. And he also, I guess, there's a band called Pavlov's Dog. Have I listened to one of their records? I cannot remember. But he appears on one of their records at the Sound of the Bell, which again is like a session musician hired gun thing. He also started the band National Health with friend Dave Stewart. Not that Dave Stewart, another Dave Stewart.
The Canterbury Dave Stewart.
Yes, Canterbury Dave Stewart. Yes, who was coming off of his stint with...
Hatfield in the North, right?
Yeah, yeah. Cause he was an egg. And then... He was never in Caravan. No, he did Egg. He was in Con, that Space Shanty album with Steve Hillage. Hatfield in the North, which was also kind of a super group as well. Like those two Hatfield and the North records are fucking incredible.
They're great.
And then he forms National Health, which I think National Health was meant to be like Hatfield and the North, but like pure jazz, like as pure of a jazz fusion band as he could get. And Bruford had left before they had recorded like their first record, though he does appear on, they did like a little archive record sometime in the 90s. They put out like some
Missing
some older
Pieces.
Stuff. Missing Pieces. Thank you.
Yeah,
Bill's on a couple of those tracks, as well as I think like Alan Gowan, because it was originally like a two keyboard band. They had Mont Campbell, who is the bassist and singer in Egg. He joined that band. Apparently, he was, according to Mont, from like I think it was like a Canterbury Scene documentary done a while ago. He talked about how he was like the main songwriter and bringing in these like more complex pieces, and it just wasn't like clicking, I guess. And it was sort of like Mont's last major thing he did before he just kind of disappeared, especially from like Western music. And and he just does just kind of random shit here and there, or at least a lot of the stuff that he does is much more on the, I think, like the library music kind of side, like more just kind of like world music stuff, like public domain kind of thing. Yeah, he's had quite an interesting life. You know, Western music wasn't for him, and that's perfectly fine. And then also at this time, after Bruford, I think Bruford left this because he got the invitation from Phil Collins to guest on Brand X. And as we know,
before we move on to Brand X, so with National Health, oh shit. I'm totally blanking here. Oh, that's right. So on Gradually Going Tornado, the last Bruford album, last track, Land's End, in the instrumental section, it sounds like a reprise of The Bride and Two Step for Amphibians, the National Health song. So like I wonder that was on the second album, but I wonder if they had written it when like they were first starting out. And then Bill just used it again for his band.
It's very possible. I mean, Dave Stewart's in Bruford's band as well, so it's very possible. But we can get into that in a little bit. Because also, Steve Hillage was in National Health as well for a little bit. And the idea of Steve Hillage and Bruford playing together sounds really nice to me.
Yeah.
Anyways, so Bill gets the invite from his... friend, I guess. They were friends, I would say. Phil Collins, to do the Brand X thing. In fact, I think Phil Collins set up Bruford's drums at like an early Yes gig at one point. And Phil has mentioned that in that weird period where Bill left, in like the early part when they were looking for a drummer, like Phil introduced himself to John Anderson. And John had said, oh yeah, like here's my number. We'll give you an audition. And Phil never called them back. And he said, and he's often wondered if he did, and say he got the gig, what would have happened? Could be a fascinating
alternate universe.
That is very much an alternate universe idea, because I'm sure Phil would have got the gig. Anyways, So they were friends. They had a very sort of similar style, and Brand X was Phil Collins' like jazz fusion side project away from his normal day job. And there was some stuff going on at his normal day job where, you know, their lead singer had, you know, put the pain away for good and instead was going to be a vegetable farmer. And they were auditioning like 5 million lead singers and they all sucked. And the only good one was the dude playing hitting the tin cans in the back. And Phil's like, well, if I do this, I have to step out and sing. And I'd always wondered why Phil never did both. And I think in his memoir, he had said that the only reason he didn't drum and sing at the same time, because he could have done it. I mean, there's like music videos of him doing it on like No Reply at All and Abacab and all this other stuff. Like there's footage of him doing it. He could have done it. But
yeah,
he has said that the reason he didn't was the drum kit would get in the way. Because as the singer, you need to like present and sort of be the MC, as you will, for the audience. And having this big old drum kit in the way of him, he said it would create a bit of a disconnect with the audience and with him trying to sing the words. So he had to step out and do it. And doing that, he was worried about the music falling apart behind him. Because Genesis were always a very well-prepared band. And so it was either Bill saying to Phil or Phil saying to Bill, no one remembers who, why doesn't Bill step in while Phil is getting comfortable being the lead singer, and Bill will sit in the back and play the drums because he knows he can trust him to do it correctly. And that's how it went. And so famously on the Trick of the Tail tour, Mr. Bill Bruford was the special guest for that tour while Phil was sort of getting comfortable being the lead singer. And I believe people at those shows would shout for Bruford a lot of the time. There's probably a couple King Crimson shouts here and there. In fact, I think Phil had said to Bill, you know, doing this, he's like, do you really want to do this again? Because you've already been here with like Yes and King Crimson. Like, do you want to do this again? And Bill's like, yeah, I'll do it. I'll do it. Why not?
And the bootlegs from that tour are so fun to listen to. Like, unfortunately, there aren't really any that have great quality, but when everyone, when they introduce Bill Bruford, like you hear the crowd just go nuts.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because if you are in a Genesis crowd in 1976, you know who the hell Bill Bruford is.
Yeah. Like,
that's definitely your crowd. And there are some official recordings of Bill there. The version of Cinema Show on Seconds Out is him. The version of It/Watcher of the Skies at the end of Three Sides Live is also him. I believe those are the only times they've officially had Bruford playing drums on there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Cool. I thought that was Alchester.
Nope. That is Bill. The It/Watcher of the Skies is Bill. The rest of it's Chester. And yeah, it's weird to think about this whole like him being in Genesis, you know, because I think Bill would say he didn't fit, and he said he was a real prick on tour. In his book, he goes about it in detail on how he became really like a prima donna, because even though he was still in his hired gun phase, I think he sensed in himself that he can't be that he has to be like a part of the music and a part of the creation process. And so he said he would step in and make a lot of comments when they shouldn't have been made, and like really tried to force himself into the role of being one of the members of the band. And he said he felt so bad about it because the rest of the band was so nice to him. And Genesis, of course, always let their families up. So his wife came with them, and I don't know if they had any children yet, but you know, his wife was on tour with him as well, which was a rare thing. And he's like, they were so nice and gracious to us. And I was just such a dick to him the whole time. And they just all took it. They all just took it because they're like, oh, it's Bill Bruford. It's Phil's friend. You know, we'll be nice to him. And yeah, on those bootlegs. Peter
responds to mistreatment from Bill Bruford. And what are you going to do?
Yeah. And on the little bit I've heard of Bill in there, I mean, you can tell he's really trying to be him in the music. You know, like he's not playing Phil's parts perfectly at all. He is getting a lot of free reign to just kind of do what he wants. Like he's playing it as if it's like a King Crimson gig.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of points where it's like he's doing things that feel like they completely don't fit at all, but But you go with it because it's kind of a weird period for the band. I believe this was like they pulled out White Mountain from Trespass of all teams.
Yeah, with the incredible intro from Mike. Oh, yeah. So there was there's one bootleg I know of that was, it's interesting. Like you can tell like Bill just kind of loses his place in Robbery, Assault and Battery in that Tony Banks' solo with that weird time signature. Like you listen to it, he is like totally off. Like just a totally different time signature from what like Phil played on the album. And like it's kind of hard to tell like how much of it was like deliberate and how much was just him fucking around or whatever.
It sounds like him just fucking around. Like his time in Genesis feels like he was very much just fucking around and was just having fun with the whole thing, you know? Cause I think he was lost after Crim.
Yeah.
Cause he fit into Crimson like a glove. He loved it. You know, he's always talked about King Crimson in Reverence. Like that was his gig. That was his dream gig.
He describes it as his spiritual home on a bed of nails.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And I think for Bill, that's what he wanted. Like he needed that excitement and he wasn't going to get it in Yes. And he wasn't going to get it in Genesis. So King Crimson was really what he needed. But the problem was it was being led by somebody who was more fucking crazy than he was. So it was just, you know, in a constant state of flux, as they would say. So it was around this time where I think, you know, Bruford had, you know, become friends with, say, like Dave Stewart and all these guys within the Canterbury scene. And I think it was Dave Stewart who initially suggested to him, like, dude, why don't you just form your own band? You know, instead of doing this constant hopping around bands and doing all this session work that we know you don't like because it's not really what you do, you need to be a part of the music. Why don't you start creating your own music? And Bill kind of reluctantly went along with it, you know, like he's like, yeah, I think I should do this. And that's where he really started to play the piano and learn how to write, though he said Dave Stewart gave him a lot of help in the composition part, being more of a straight up keyboardist. And he assembled a little band that is known as the Bruford Band, though it was just called Bruford. But I think we tend to call it as like the Bruford Band just to kind of like separate it from everything.
Yeah.
And it was Dave Stewart, Bill Bruford as well. On bass, we have Mr. Jeff Berlin, who was in that sort of Jaco Pastorius kind of thing where he's doing like fretless, very high, like treble sort of on the tone and everything, and just really doing these very fast technical runs. Like,
yeah,
bouncy and burbly. Yeah, this was the era of, like, you know, Jaco was in Weather Report, and Weather Report were huge at the time, and Jaco was becoming a superstar bass player of all things. Like, he wasn't a singer or anything, he was just a bass player, and everyone was just so amazed by what he was doing at the time.
Wentz of the 70s, except he can actually play bass.
Though I think Jaco got bigger not because of Pete Wentz stuff. Anyways, Jeff Berlin kind of fit in with that. Also, like Percy Jones from Brand X was very much in that style as well. And I've always been a huge Percy Jones fan. I just love the sort of tone and creativity that he has with the fretless bass. Like, the man is a fucking monster. But if you listen to, say, his appearances on those Eno records that he did, he knows like when to have like restraint and sort of let the bass kind of just do its normal job as well. You know, I've always been a fan of Percy Jones for that as well.
Admirable restraint.
Absolutely. And Jeff Berlin doesn't have any of that. He just fucking rips. He's ripping all the time. It is crazy. But I think it's because he's trying to keep up with really the main guy here outside of Bill, Mr. Alan Holdsworth.
Yeah.
Alan Holdsworth. I mean, what a beast. What an incredible man. Like, probably one of the best guitar players to ever exist. Just an absolute savant of the instrument.
The chords that man could do, like, it's how, like, hypermobility in his hands or something.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that he had all that talent, you know, in a way that, like, unfortunately, not a lot of people ever appreciated or ever will, because he never did anything really that. I mean, probably the most notable thing he did was the first UK record, as far as like popular kind of stuff. I think Bill had heard him on, say, like those Soft Machine records that he did, or he was on, I believe, the new Tony Williams Lifetime as well. He also did an album with Gong. He actually appeared on an album of Gong's. Gazette. I don't know how to pronounce half these fucking titles. But that might have been that weird period where Gong was starting to sort of splinter, I think. I think it was becoming that point for Gong. But I think Bill had heard that stuff and heard what this guy was capable of and was like, well, fucking shit, we need to get him on here. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if he also heard him on the Jean-Luc Ponty album that he's on. Speaking of Frank Zappa, Jean-Luc Ponty, another fantastic jazz fusion violin player. He played with Zappa. In fact, I think Zappa kind of discovered him. But then Jean used that sort of to branch off into his own solo records. And his solo records in the 70s, I think they're all like fantastic.
Great stuff.
Yeah, Upon the Wings of Music, Aurora, Imaginary Voyage. Ooh, that's like one of my favorite jazz records, like jazz fusion records. Love that fucking thing. Cosmic Messenger, Taste for Passion, but the album I'm talking about is Ignamic Ocean from 77, which is, like, the front cover is just his face, you know, on a beach, which is an interesting idea for a cover. But that album has, the lineup is Jean, Alan Holdsworth, Daryl Sturmer,
wow,
another Genesis connection, Ralphie Armstrong, Alan Zavod, and Steve Smith, like a fantastic collection of jazz fusion players. In fact, this is where Daryl Sturmer got some notoriety, was playing with Jean-Luc Ponty at this period. He appears on a couple other records. I think he's on the live album around that same era. And it's basically believed that that's where Phil Collins discovered Daryl Sturmer, was through the Jean-Luc Ponty stuff, because Phil was a big fan of fusion music. And it makes perfect sense, like bringing in like a really good, talented player. And Alan Holdsworth is on that record as well. So hearing Alan Holdsworth and Daryl Sturmer sort of trade off solos is pretty fucking fantastic, because Daryl Sturmer doesn't get enough credit as a guitar player. Like, he is a genuinely fantastic guitar player.
Yeah. Like, I don't like everything he does, but definitely, like, there's definitely a reason that Genesis kept him as their touring guitarist, and, like, he worked with Phil on his solo stuff, too.
Yeah. Yeah, like his, I've listened to some of his solo stuff, and it's okay. It's nothing that amazing, but again, as you had said, he's such a talented player that it would just make sense to keep him around. Like, he's just so good, and he's so, like, friendly. Like, every interview I've seen with him, he's just such a nice, lovely man. That's like, yeah, I want to keep this guy around. He seems like just a sweetheart, and he can just fucking rip. But that's probably that. But through those connections, I think, is where Holdsworth got introduced to Bill Bruford. And Bruford's like, oh, I got to use this guy. Like, this guy's incredible, you know?
It was around this time. Like, he talked about that lineup, I think. And he said, like, he would have paid to be in his own gig. But I think that just really goes to show, like, that quote about working with Alan Holdsworth, like, it definitely says a lot about, like, how incredibly talented he was. And it's also interesting, like, listening to UK and Bruford and, like, hearing Alan Holdsworth playing and, like, kind of comparing that to Fripp. Like, those styles are very different.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I feel that Alan Holdsworth's style is a little more, like, fluid. And I would describe Fripp as more like angular, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. But before we get into the UK, let's briefly touch on the Bruford trilogy. Feels Good to Me, One of a Kind, and Gradually Going Tornado. This is an interesting trilogy of records. that it is Bill really kind of exploring his compositional chops and trying to make something that's more appealing to him, something that kind of represents sort of what he's feeling musically. And I think all three of these records are very interesting for what they are. You have like Feels Good to Me, which has that really weird cover of Bill like gripping like a drum key or something in front of a gong. It's very weird.
I will never forgive myself for 5 years ago. I went to a record store and I saw that album, but I didn't get it. I just got the ELP debut instead. It is a great album, though. Like, it's interesting to hear like more like keyboard synths than like electric guitar in there.
I think it's solid, but it's not my favorite of the three. It starts out really strong. Like the first half is fantastic. Beelzebub, Back to the Beginning, that seems like a lifetime ago, part one and two, and Sample and Hold. Great.
Yeah, and it seems like a lifetime ago is kind of interesting. Like having that woman, Annette Peacock, on vocals, like, kind of gives sort of, like, a lighter feeling to the music, where, like, so much of it is so, like, instrumentally heavy. It kind of has, like, a nice contrast.
Yeah, yeah, and she has such a interesting voice. You know, she kind of does the... She's almost like a female Lou Reed, just the way she kind of presents her voice, but she also has that, like Chrissy Hynde from The Pretenders kind of like almost kind of delivery to her voice as well, you know, sort of that like, you know, I'm hot shit kind of thing as well. But doing these.
Yeah,
kind of
like kind of like seductive lyrics. Almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And Annette actually also she has a solo career herself. And I believe her second record, X Dreams, is basically another Bruford record because Bill's on that record, as is like Holdsworth, Jeff Berlin, Dave Stewart. Like they all appear on this record as well. I'm pretty sure. Looking at the credits, I see Bill on here because I know Bill helped out on this record. That's probably like a thank you to her for, you know, doing what she did.
Yeah.
I can't remember if the other guys are on there. Let's see. Trying to see if I can get a better listing of everybody. Yeah, Bruford's on. Yeah, I only see Bruford from this on here. But yeah, if you ever get a chance, like if you like Feels Good to Me, look up X Dreams, the Annette Peacock record. It's very similar, but it's she's more in control of it. And it is a fascinating record. Like it starts with a track called My Mama Never Taught Me How to Cook, which is a pretty weird track. She even covers like a Otis Blackwell, Elvis Presley tune on here. It's pretty neat. It's a pretty neat record.
Sounds interesting.
Oh yeah. So, but the second half of this record for me, doesn't hit as well. It's not bad, but it feels like it goes into more traditional jazz, which I like, but it feels like it kind of loses its focus a little bit. Whereas the first half is very much like trying to be like New York fusion. Like that's the vibe I'm getting from it. And then by the second half, it's like Bill wants to do more of like the acoustic jazz stuff. I mean, I hear even little shades of Earthworks in there. Just like teeny bits. Just little teeny, teeny little droplets. Like little bits of earth sprinkled on there.
It's just like the tiny little seeds of being planted.
Exactly. And this album also has... Neil Murray does a little bit of bass, and even John Goodsall from Brand X appears on the title track as well, which is pretty neat. It's a pretty neat record, though. I think most of us agree, with me when I say the second record, One of a Kind, is much better. Like this is the one to listen to. Like the first half is also fantastic, but the second half really keeps that momentum going. You know, like the Sahara of Snow at the end is fantastic. But when I was listening to this record again, it was the first time in quite a while I've ever listened to this record. And the first thing I thought was, this is just a Weather Report album. It sounds just like Heavy Weather, Mr. Gone, a little bit of Black Market. It like that, like sort of Jaco late 70s era of Weather Report is all over it. You know, with those heavy Jeff Berlin, Jaco style riffs, the Dave Stewart keyboards, a lot of the synth sounds as well, I think, are channeling Joe Zawinul and sort of the ARP synths that he loved to do at that time.
Yeah, and I noticed it has, like, even then, like, the really jazzy instrumental tracks, like, some of them have, like a really strong hook, which is something that, like, Weather Report does occasionally, and, like, Hell's Bells, like, or whenever this comes on, like, me and my partner listening to Spotify in the car, I sing along to the intro, and I just go, Bill Bruford, Billy Bill.
I mean, Hell's Bells.
Bill Bruford, Bruins overalls, Crispy Snares.
Hell's Bells, honestly, it feels like it sounds like the intro to, like, some, like, 80s news broadcast.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It does. Yeah. That synth sound.
Boop, 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 boop. And just that banging of the rototom and all that.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of corny or almost, like, kind of cheesy, but it has that charm, especially when the song kicks in. It's like, okay, we're moving. We're doing just fine. And then like the title track, I think, is fantastic. Fainting in Coils is really cool. 5G fucking slaps. Holy shit.
Oh yeah.
That song is amazing. Wow.
Yeah, that's one of his best.
Absolutely. And as I'd said, like, the Sahara of Snow, I've always really, really enjoyed. Yeah, it's a great record. It's definitely the one to listen to.
Like,
if you want, like, I think it encompasses his entire solo, even like Earthworks. Like, this is the one for me. You know, like, Earthworks.
I would agree.
Like, Earthworks is its own thing. You know, like, definitely would be worth exploring on its own. But that is, like, pure jazz. Like, 1,000%. Whereas this is still kind of in that weird jazz rock hybrid thing. There's maybe, like, some shade. Yeah, there's some shades of Crimson in there. But I think it's more, like, this album is kind of a sister record to the first UK record. Which we'll touch on in just a second, because let's see, Gradually Going Tornado, the misfit of the three, came out 2 years later in 1980, because One of a Kind was 79, but it was 79, so that was after UK, and then Gradually Going Tornado was after that, and you can feel that this is kind of the end. That they're kind of
Jeff Berlin on vocals.
He's not a good singer. He's really not a good singer.
No.
and I believe, Holdsworth isn't even on this one. It's instead John Clark, the unknown John Clark, as they call him on here. He's okay. He's no fucking Holdsworth, but, you know, who would, you know?
Yeah. And that album does have, like, it has its moments for sure. Like, Frazier, that's another sing-along riff. Sing along to that. Like, Bill Bruford.
I'm sure he appreciates you singing him on his songs. And it ends with Land's End, which is actually, I think, a pretty unique tune. And that's a good one for the Bruford era to sort of end on. Because
Really interesting thing about that one is that they reprise a National Health song, a Bread and Two Step for Amphibians.
Yeah, it could have been intentional, or it could have just been one of those coincidences that happen, especially when you have the guy who wrote the other one in the band. You know, you never know.
I could see them being like, hey, this sounded cool. Let's just put it on here.
I think that's a fair assessment to make.
Yeah. Because
that's probably what happened. So all this roundabout to get to UK, which, of course, Bruford brought in Alan Holdsworth to make this four-piece, this weird four-piece when you think about it. You have the used King Crimson rhythm section, a jazz guitar player who is still kind of relatively unknown at this point, and a violinist keyboardist who has kind of been around, like a journeyman keyboard violinist who's very talented, but he hadn't really found a home yet, you know, and never really would as well. Because I think after this, he was in Jethro Tull for a little bit. He was in Yes for a little bit. And then he eventually did his own solo stuff as well. And his solo stuff gives me Nash the Slash vibes a little bit, you know, the that sort of stuff. But in any case, all that to say, we are now at UK, which was probably the big topic for this one, because we had to talk about UK. I think Fripp once was quoted as saying UK is King Crimson without him. And yeah. For me, I do not agree.
Yeah, I don't really agree either, because it seems like UK is very keyboard synth heavy, and that's something that King Crimson didn't do at all. And though John Wetton and Bill Bruford are there, it's still just a very distinct sound from any version of Crimson.
Yeah, I feel like Fripp said that because, in a way, you could say Alan Holdsworth is the replacement for Fripp, which is good. I mean, that's a good comparison to make, and I'm sure Holdsworth was probably he probably appreciated the compliment. But as you had said, their playing is very, very different. They come from very different ends of the spectrum. And it's a shame that Holdsworth isn't, he's not that prominent on this record.
Yeah.
But I think that's because he's working with three other musicians who have very big egos and are not afraid of saying what they want to say and inserting themselves into the music. Because Holdsworth was much more of a session guy, kind of lower tier, didn't make a big splash. And the only reason he's here is because Bruford is the one vouching for him, saying no, this guy needs to be here. And the guitar that is on the first UK record is very good. I love his solo on In the Dead of the Night. Famously, Wetton and Jobson wanted him to play that solo the same way when they were touring. And Holdsworth just didn't understand that. Playing the solo the same way every night. He didn't, because he was from a jazz background. He's like, what the fuck are you talking about? So on live versions, he would play a different solo. It was kind of close. He would try to stay a little bit within it to please them, but he was more just kind of vamping, doing the Holdsworth thing, which is what you want. You want Holdsworth to be himself,
Yeah, but, if you're going to have Alan fucking Holdsworth to play guitar in your band, then you're going to need to let Alan Holdsworth play the way he wants.
Exactly. Exactly. So before we get too deep into the music, UK, what do you think of that band name?
I think it's fucking stupid. I was saying this to my partner earlier. I don't like band names that are well-known locations.
Asia, America, Japan. Yeah, I agree.
Come on.
It's annoying to look up.
Yeah.
At least Emerson, Lake and Palmer, the other supergroup, the UK was kind of also considered the second version of ELP, but they're very different bands. But at least with Emerson, Lake and Palmer, you can type that in and they know what you're talking about. Right.
Yeah, instead of Asia band or UK band.
Well, UK band still doesn't help, because then they're bands from the UK. It's like, shit, UK prog band. Shit, that doesn't work either. Fuck, I don't know.
Yeah, you have to put UK John Wetton.
Yeah, UK prog band 1978. No, shit, there's a bunch of those too. Fuck. We're screwed here. and that album cover. I'm not.
Where do
I
got the idea for that one?
Well, I hate the logo in the corner that just looks like a discount sort of thing.
Yeah,
get it 20% off or whatever. That just feels very thrown together. In fact, do I have that album on vinyl? I might. Hold on.
All right. I used to have it, but unfortunately, when I had to sell some of my record collection, I sold that one too.
Oh. I do. It was sitting next to my Utopia, Todd Rundgren's Utopia. Well, that's a whole nother beast entirely. Yeah, here. Yeah, this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not even sure how they got the cover. I don't know. It just looks like I'm tripping on acid or something. It's very weird. 'Cause you have Bruford at the top. You have Bruford at 12. Wetton at 9, Holdsworth at 6, and Jobson at 3 o'clock, if kids know what a fucking analog clock is, but, you know. And then the back cover is this, like, satellite picture of the UK. Like, the whole thing feels, like, the whole package feels very slapdash, you know? They're just like, oh, shit, we need to do this, and...
Yeah, they even use, like, a similar idea for the front cover as Red, where, like, it's all just... their faces in the shadows.
Yeah, but I think at least like the King Crimson logo there is really cool, and then the back of it is like that sort of voltage meter. Like here, like the front cover isn't bad. It's interesting, but it's like this logo doesn't work. And then the back of it, it just feels very bland. That it's like this band is representing the UK. Like this is 1978, baby. Like prog and like this kind of like jazzy prog rock wasn't really the UK representation anymore. Like we were starting to move on from that.
Yeah. You know?
So, but in any case, the music itself, I haven't listened to this album in full in a long time, because usually I would listen to like the first half and then just leave. And I was reminded of why I do that. This album starts out incredibly strong. In the Dead of the Night, By the Light of Day, and then Presto Vivace, and Reprise that form like the little In the Dead of the Night suite is fantastic. Like it's the best thing on the record. It's what UK are known for. You know, it feels like the best representation of this idea of like these four musicians getting together to make something that's a little proggy, a little jazzy, a little poppy. Very 1978, especially with the synthesizer sounds that they're using. Wetton really trying to be the proper singer here. Like that, it's definitely what it feels like. You know, it's almost borderline arena rock, but like, arena rock in like 7-8.
Yeah, like you can almost kind of picture him like singing that in like a big stadium.
Yeah, and I think that was the idea behind this band as well, was to be like a big, like stadium band, because I believe this record did get a lot of attention at the time and actually was pretty successful for what it was. I'm pretty sure, because I'm sure there was a lot of hype around, like, oh, like look at what these guys are doing, and the album was in the top 50 in the UK. Hit number 65 in the U.S. So, you know, not a bad start, though they didn't have any charting singles. Like, In the Dead of the Night didn't chart as a single or anything. And I know they went on a tour, because the first U.K. tour was in 78. And there is a very rough bootleg released of it, like, officially, Concert Classics Volume 4, I believe. So if you want to hear them playing live, you can listen to that. Though I think there was that big box set they did that I think everybody forgot about, except for me, the Ultimate Collector's Edition. It was during that like King Crimson run of all those big box sets. They're like, oh, let's do one for UK.
And there's two albums.
Well, no, they remastered the first record, did something called UK Extras, which is the whole album again. I don't know what's different about it. And then a couple of live shows, which I'm told are very rough quality. And oh yeah, you're right, they do remaster the second record as well, and then the live album they did of the second version of the band, Night After Night, which was released at the same time. Yeah, that was
so. And then the four disc set.
This is like how many discs is this damn thing? It's 14 discs or 14 14 CDs, four Blu-rays, and a 66 page book detailing the band's history. Like it's meant to be like a King Crimson style box set for UK. But I know it was
history of a band that existed for a single year.
Well, actually, they existed a little bit longer than that. And I know it had a very limited print run when it came out, and I considered buying it, but it was very expensive, and I'm sure now is only more expensive. And none of those remasters of those records have ever been available any other way, as far as I know. Like, this is the only way to hear those original remasters. But I'm sure they're nothing that amazing, but still. But in any case, sorry. I got sidetracked.
Hey, good.
Yeah, the end of the Dead of the Night suite is fantastic. And then the first side ends with a track called 30 Years, which is quite a long track, surprisingly. And it's not bad as well. It's, you know, kind of continuing that sort of in the Dead of the Night sort of momentum, but doing something a little different with it. In fact, some people have compared this record to ELP. Like, there are certain elements of some of the songs that have an Emerson, Lake, and Palmer vibe to it.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think about that?
I would definitely agree. Just that kind of like showiness and like melodramatic kind of.
Yeah, a lot of like chuggy rhythms, a lot of odd times, and you know, it's like elements of Tarkus in here and there.
Yeah.
A bit of that. And it's weird to think that like Bill Bruford would be influenced by Carl Palmer, but I think there's a little bit of that in here. Maybe it's just because they were thinking about ELP at the time. Because people were probably making those comparisons to them. So it was probably just fresh in their brains, I think.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But yeah, what do you think of this first side?
I agree. I think it's better. The first side's definitely better than the second half. And it's interesting to listen to because what we said earlier about how Fripp said that this was what King Crimson would sound like without him, like, I don't agree with that at all. Like, this is, even with, like, you know, different time signatures and, like, the jazziness, like, it's a lot more accessible. And, like, some of it's almost, like, party music.
Imagine somebody putting this on at a party in, like, the late 70s. They probably want to hear The Clash or something.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, so that goes into the second side, which I think starts out interesting, but ends very kind of flatly, I think, for me. Like, it opens with the track Alaska, which is this big glacial synthy kind of piece that I really like. I mean, I've always been a fan of, like, synths and electronic bullshit, and this is kind of part of that. And I know some people have complained about the synths on this record and how they just, like, this was the era where synthesizers started sounding like how you think they sound, you know, like, we're getting out of that Moog, ARP, like, heavy analog synths, and we're starting to drift into, like, the Yamaha and the Korgs and the more kind of, like, borderline digital synths, which have a different vibe to them.
Yeah, and they have a very distinct feeling to them, too, like, you hear that synth and they're like, oh, yeah, late 70s.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, like in early 80s as well. Like, these were all over records back then. But I don't know. I've always had an appreciation for them as long as they're used correctly.
Same,
you know,
here.
What I mean?
Yeah.
And I think Alaska is a really good example of them. I've always really appreciated this track for being kind of a synth showpiece, especially for Jobson. And then we get into Time to Kill, which is okay. It's not bad, but, like, writing a song about, you know, having nothing to do, I don't know. It feels like it's too accurate of a portrayal of the band. You know what I mean? That this was just formed out of, like, needing to do something. I'm not sure. But the last two tracks, Nevermore and Mental Medication, I don't like either of these tracks. They don't really work. I think Mental Medication has a Bill Bruford doing the lyrics for it, and the lyrics are kind of not great. You know, like the song's Mental Medication, right? It has that Asian ending, so a lot of the words are, you know, like meditation, medication, inspiration, you know, that kind of thing, and it doesn't work for me. This album starts out with, like, it's gonna be, it starts out really strong, but it ends on like a really good meal, and then it ends on like a bad fart. Which is a shame, because there's a lot of talent here, and clearly these guys know what they're doing, but I think it's just a rough record to truly appreciate what it could be, because it sounds to me like there isn't enough cohesion that having the two camps, the Wetton and Bruford camp, was a bad idea, and because they're constantly in conflict with each other. Because you have Bruford and Holdsworth trying to push the band in these instrumental jazzy sections and the odd time signatures. And then you have Wetton and Jobson being like, no, we got to write songs and have hits. You know, we got to be on the charts, man. And these two just never really compromise. You know, they just kind of like, okay, this is a Wetton Jobson section of the song. Okay, we'll drift into a little Bruford Holdsworth instrumental. We'll come back into it. You know, like In the Dead of the Night, that whole suite feels very like the four of them getting together to write something truly amazing. And then the rest of it just feels like little bits and pieces here and there. You know, like there are moments on this record past that that are really good. Like there's bits here and there. But overall, it's just sadly not as strong as it could be. And I think that's what makes this record kind of a controversial one in the prog sphere. You know, some people really like it. Some people really don't like it. And I can see both sides to it. But where do you stand on this one, Ave?
I am kind of in the middle. Like, I basically agree with you. Like, I think Nevermore is an all right song, but I'm not a fan of Mental Medication either. But like this is just an album that like I never really put on like and go out of my way for. It's all right, but I'm like, if I wanted to hear John Wetton sing, then I'll just listen to King Crimson.
Yeah, I don't blame you on there. And then they would do that little tour, and then Bruford and Holdsworth kind of fucked off. So I think they realized they really weren't going to get their way. And they probably realized, oh, we just have the Bruford band. Like, why don't we just do what we want to do over here and leave them alone? You know? So it feels like this was almost pointless. But Wetton and Jobson would carry on with UK. They actually got another Frank Zappa alum to join them, Mr. Terry Bozzio, on the drums. And they became a three-piece. And they did the second album, Danger Money, released in 1979. And for this record, this is the first time I've listened to this record in like 10 years. Like, I listened to it once when I was getting into everything, you know, to hear it. And I was like, eh, whatever, right? There's no proof. Who cares, right? That was my thought at the time. But I re-listened to it for this, and I gotta say, it's kind of good. Like, I really liked this record. It surprised me. I think what helps is it has much more cohesion to it. Because you have Wetton and Jobson at the helm doing their thing. And Terry Bozzio, I think, is just kind of willing to go along with it. You know, like he doesn't have an ego that he needs to soothe with this. I think he's doing it because he worked with Jobson with Zappa, so he has that connection. And it allows, and having the three piece allows the music to kind of breathe a little bit more. You know, Jobson can kind of expand more with the synths and do a lot more violin work as well. There's some really cool violin parts on here. And Bozio's drums are very complimentary to what's going on here. You know, like it took me a long time to really like Bozzio as a drummer, like a long time, but I've come around to him, you know, and I respect a lot of what he's able to do, especially with like Frank and all this other stuff. I still have yet to sit down and listen to Missing Persons. So one of these days I will do that. But yeah, like Danger Money, like it's like the first side's not bad. But the second side, I thought, is really, really good. Like Caesar Palace Blues, Nothing to Lose, and Carrying No Cross. I thought like that final stretch was just really, really strong. And it kind of surprised me. You know, I wasn't sure what to think about this one at all. But I came out of it like pretty high on it. Did you listen to this one again? Or what are your thoughts on this one?
I actually have not listened to that one for this. I think I listened to that album like once a couple years ago, and it was like, for me, like, I don't think it's bad at all, but it didn't really click with me. Like, but the same, I kind of feel similar about the first UK album too, where it's just like, not for some reason, like, I'm just not as big a fan of it as like some other stuff.
I can understand. I think it's worth trying again.
Yeah.
Because that would have been my thought on it had I not listened to it at all. But excuse me. But there's your burp for you. But I had, you know, a little free time. So I was like, hey, let me listen to it. You know, I think it's like 46 minutes or so, 42 minutes. So it's a pretty quick listen. And yeah, I was surprised at the quality of it. So I'd say it's definitely worth checking out. So Danger Money UK, a hidden gem for you. And that would sort of be the end of UK. I know they did that Night After Night live record, and then they kind of reformed in the 2010s as that three piece again. And they would do stuff from the first record and the second record, but it never became like a big thing, you know. It kind of just became this sort of little stopgap, I think, for everybody involved. Like everybody kind of moved on to other things, you know, like Jobson would move on to working with other bands and doing his solo stuff. Terry Bozzio would form Missing Persons, like a new wave band in the 80s that actually had a fair amount of success. In fact, a little side note for you, Weird Al's first gig was opening for Missing Persons.
Really?
And that crowd fucking hated him. There's a funny story about that. I think it's on his Behind the Music special. He talks about it, and it's definitely worth looking at, because I think he said at the end of the gig, some kid comes up to him and says, hey, are you Weird Al? And he goes, yeah. And the kid goes, you suck. This is like pre-Eat It. So it goes pre-first album. I don't know if he had done the first album yet.
Wow.
But yeah, that happened with those. And then John Wetton, as I think all of us know, went on to form Asia. Fucking Asia. I tried. Asia are weird. They're a weird band when you really think about them. And I tried listening to the first album again for this. I think I got to like the third track and just kind of gave up.
Yeah, I could never do Asia as
I had a little bit of fan. I had a little bit of a soft spot for him a long time ago. I think it was me just trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, because I'm like, oh, it has John Wetton, it has Steve Howe, you know, Carl Palmer, like all these, you know, great musicians. So I'm like, yeah, surely it's got to be good. And then they make that music, and it just And I think especially now that I've listened to so much more 80s music and I have a better idea of what like good stuff was going on at that time, that going back to Asia, it's like, Jesus fucking Christ, like what the hell? Like this, it feels sloppy. Like there's something about the first Asia record that's like no disrespect to Carl Palmer, but that man does not play drums in the way that like other drummers do. Like he can't hold a beat to save his fucking life. Like he does a lot of cool frilly stuff, but when it comes to just playing a beat, he's just not that great at it. I mean, listen to ELP. He's not really doing that much like beats. Not really. Like the most is like Tarkus is really the most like him doing like a driving backbeat, and he's great at that, but just keeping it kind of simple. Like no, Carl Palmer didn't do anything simple. You know?
Yeah. Well, like, it's just so weird to hear like these big prog guys attempt to do like radio friendly, like arena rock.
Yeah. Which I think we know that that's what Wetton wanted to do.
Yeah.
That was sort of his end goal, and he got it. Like, he was a singer. He sang on like a big hit single, Heat of the Moment. We all know Heat of the Moment. It's a big tune. You'll still hear it on radio here and there. You'll probably hear it when you go shopping at your local grocery store. Like, it's just one of those kind of tunes, right? And it's okay. I've always found it to be very herky-jerky in the rhythm, and the composition is just kind of all over the place. Like, it's not as well composed as it should be, you know, especially with the people who are working on it. But it feels like Asia was created because these four guys wanted to make some money. And they made a lot of money on Asia.
Yeah.
Like there's a reason Asia still kind of exists to this day. And it's been through a lot of different eras with a lot of different lineups and a lot of cool Roger Dean album covers. I fucking love looking at Asia album covers. You know, like the first one is that dragon. And that dragon's super cool. Alpha is like the pyramid. You have like Aqua, which is like a flying dolphin in space. Like, what the fuck? And then Arena is like this flying lion with eyes on the wings. Like this is like really cool album covers, but the music just doesn't reflect that at all. And it's really sad.
Yeah, it's kind of like, just because like some musicians are talented, that doesn't mean like every song that they make is going to be good.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard some of the later Asia records, like Phoenix and Omega, are better, you know, because I think by that point they were like, oh, this would be just fun to do again. You know, they weren't trying to make money. They were just trying to have a little fun. And people say they definitely do a better job of that. But the Asia story is an interesting story with a lot of ups and downs. And we're not going to go there because I don't care enough to. I don't know if you do.
Yeah, no, I don't know that much about them.
But with Asia, that's the end of our time speaking about John Wetton on this podcast, at least as a main player in the King Crimson story. So this is it for him, really. Which is weird to think about. You know, we've reached the end of a major era.
That was a good three albums.
A good three albums and some interesting stuff past that. And he became a big star, as he always wanted to be. But I think later on embraced his older stuff more.
Yeah.
Like every once in a while he would join like some random local band to do like one more Red Nightmare or Starless. And it was like, oh, that's nice of him to do.
And when he
passed, Robert Fripp wrote a nice little thing about him on the website, which was really nice. So, but we're not done with Bruford yet. Nope. He is far from done, everybody. Oh my god. But real quick before we end it, we got David Cross. There's not a huge amount of stuff on him post Crimson. I know that in the 70s, I think he took quite a bit of a sabbatical from the music industry. But by the 80s, he had come back a bit stronger, doing some more like session stuff and getting some King Crimson credits, and he even reconnected with Fripp in the 90s. And I think they ended up doing like a little collaborative album together, like some Frippatronic stuff, which is pretty neat. Yeah, Starless Starlight in 2015, which is actually a pretty neat record. And it's cool to see like David Cross and Fripp sort of collab together again, because David Cross, as we have said, kind of got the shaft when he was with them.
Yeah, he deserves so much better.
But I think these days, when people look back at this era, people are more inclined to be like, no, Cross was very integral to this lineup. And I think he gets more respect now than he ever has, which is very deserving.
Absolutely. He's an amazing violinist.
Absolutely. And yeah, that's the end of David Cross in the band as well. So that just leaves Fripp and Bruford with some other guys. Who are these other fucking weirdos that show up? These guys with like, you know, weird haircuts and big suits and then stringed instruments.
No haircut and big mustache.
Yeah. Beautiful mustache. But we will cover all of that next time when we enter the 80s properly with Discipline, with the Celtic Knot that they totally didn't get sued over, and the first track on Discipline, Elephant Talk. So until Elephant Talk, bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.